From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Depending on who you listen to, a good education is either one of the most difficult things to achieve or the simplest and most natural. This hour, we're rethinking education.
I went in when I was 16, and when I came home in 2002, I had more time in prison than out of prison. And when I left the gates of Sing Sing, I was 33 years old. The only thing I had with me was my college degree.
We should really think twice about pulling children out of the public system, that if we want to invest in our public schools, if we want to improve them over time, there's a big argument to be made that everyone has a better outcome when more people invest.
Imagine that. Imagine a classroom full of people who get it and who want the education, who are immensely grateful, who are just have that level of hunger. I mean, for teachers, it's like a drug.
You don't have to make kids love learning. You have to start by being committed to not killing the curiosity about the world that all students start out with.
Alfie Cohn has been described in Time magazine as perhaps the country's most outspoken critic of education's fixation on grades and test scores. Cohn writes in lectures about progressive education at schools, universities, and corporations, and his critiques have helped to shape the questions we're asking about education reform today. His latest book is called Feel Bad Education. Cohn says part of the problem is that we don't give kids a say in what they learn.
You can't skip the part about how kids view what they're doing. That's why research, for example, fails to show much of a benefit to homework. In fact, there's no benefit whatsoever until kids are in high school. That's directly related to the fact that most kids hate most homework and had nothing to say about what they're doing. You can't treat people in a workplace or in a classroom as if they're mechanical objects and try to squeeze performance out of them. What predicts to excellence is interest, and thus the best schools are those where their question every day as educators is, how do we help kids to become more enthusiastic about playing with words and numbers and ideas? Sadly, that concept is conspicuously missing from any discussion about school reform as the concept is talked about today.
It started, though, don't you think, as a means of assuring that every student was going to get the best available education? We saw some students coming out of our school system unable to accomplish much, and so we set about trying to find ways to standardize education to provide the best for all comers.
And what we provide is a standardized education for all comers, which actually drags everyone down. This basic narrative to which we've been exposed, that the U.S. is in trouble compared to other countries, which turns out to be only partly true with an enormous number of qualifications attached, and therefore we have to raise the level, not only distorts the reality of what we found before, but overlooks the poverty of this approach in terms of what we're experiencing today. There is a big difference between excellence and uniformity, and people who are talking about national core standards where you have to be subjected to the same basic curriculum or style of instruction, the same assessments from one area to another, that one-size-fits-all approach doesn't mean that anyone is going to be getting a better education. Or to put it differently, to say that we want high standards for schooling, which I certainly do, is very different from saying that we should have the same standards for all kids in all communities across the country. And we're being sold a bill of goods right now in terms of very prescriptive, behavioristic standards for what's taught and what's tested. I mean, the people driving this movement are much more likely to be corporate executives and politicians than to be people who really understand how learning happens. And unfortunately, a lot of educators have capitulated to this drive for uniformity, either because they're afraid to speak out or because they haven't been invited to reflect on the difference between excellence on the one hand and uniformity or competitiveness on the other.
Isn't it funny in a way that we do this? Because I think if you were to ask each of us about our children or our grandchildren, we would say, oh, but mine is special. And his approach or her approach to education shouldn't have to be the same as everybody else's because I know he has these talents or those talents.
Right, exactly. And you can't have a one-size-fits-all set of standards and tests and approach to education that overlooks what makes each child unique. The best teachers don't teach the same lesson in third grade that they taught in third grade last year or that the third grade teacher down the hall is doing. It would be odd to do that. It would be malpractice because the best curriculum is devised for and with this particular group of students based on their questions about themselves and the world, based on their capacities, their limits, based on what turns them on and is likely to help them become increasingly sophisticated. So the more we routinize the process and say it's got to be the same, we expect all of these kids to have acquired this bunch of facts by a certain time, the more we ruin education for all the kids involved, even if some parents can see the problem only when it affects their own children.
What about grading? I know that you have no great enthusiasm for it, but it is a part of our education system and has been for about as long as anybody can remember. How do you propose that we measure learning, or indeed can we measure learning if we're not grading?
The process of assessment is basically a two-step dance. First, you have to acquire information about how well each child is learning, who needs help, and with what. And then second, you have to feed back what you've learned as a teacher, perhaps with an evaluation attached, to the student and his or her parents. So there's two steps to it. You have to acquire information about the learning, and then you have to share what you know. What's really remarkable and that few of us have been asked to think about is that you never need tests for step one and you never need grades for step two. So, for example, the best teachers rarely give tests of their own devising and never pay attention to standardized test scores because they know that tests tend to measure what matters least. When kids are actively involved in meaningful projects, sometimes on their own, sometimes with other students, at the same time that they're learning, the teacher is learning about who needs help and how much kids are getting and what she needs to do to assist. The test is mostly just about how many forgettable facts the kids have shoved into their short-term memory. At the same time, once the teacher knows what's going on, the teacher would never want to reduce a child's proficiency to a summary letter or number. That has the effect mostly of trying to manipulate kids with bribes or threats into doing more of what they understandably, in many classrooms, have little interest in doing. And so the alternative to grades are either to offer a narrative report, a written summary, not using a letter like A or B or a number, to explain what's going on with the kid, or better yet, a conversation with the student and or the student's parents in order to talk about what's been going on and what our hopes are in the future.
I like the hopefulness of that, but I'm going to stick with grading for a second because I suspect that there are some other opinions you may have about it that we ought to hear. It seems to me there are two sides of the grading thing, and one of the advantages of grades is so that the outsiders who have no interest in this except that they're funding it want some measure of success. And the other is I suspect that grades may be for the ease of bad teachers.
Well, the first thing that really helps mediocre teachers is standardized testing, especially when the state has a list of standards where everyone in fourth grade in English will acquire the following competencies. The teacher doesn't have to think and be a professional educator. The teacher just has to be a test prep technician. Standardized testing is a way of making really inadequate teaching look effective because you can show higher scores when all you've done is make kids better test takers. And conversely, some of the best teaching doesn't get reflected in standardized test scores because the tests are lousy measures of anything intellectual that counts. Grades are a way not only of reflecting what the teacher thinks the kid has done, but of trying to control the classroom by saying, if you don't study this, if you don't come here on time, if you don't memorize more facts on command, your grade will drop. So it's a way of doing things to students to make them comply rather than working with students to help them learn. That's why the best teachers minimize grades if they have to give them at all.
Well, that does flip you to the other side of the equation, which is the student. And I suppose that grades, we've all been patterned to believe in grades, but there are other effects to grades for the students, aren't there? You start saying, well, it doesn't really matter how that works as long as I know what the answer is.
The research on grading has found three robust effects when you compare students who are told this is for a grade with students who are not graded, but they're given the identical stuff to learn. The students who are trying to get a good grade, A, tend to become less interested in whatever it is they're doing. Every study on that topic has found that result. Students are less excited about reading, about math, about this particular topic, if they're trying to do it for a grade. B, students trying to get a good grade will pick the easiest possible task if they're given a choice when they're doing it for a grade. Not because they're lazy, but because they're rational. Duh, they figure, the simpler the thing I'm doing, the better the chance I can give you what you seem to want, which is not intellectual risk-taking. It's the opposite of risk-taking. It's just to get an A. And C, kids who are trying to get a good grade tend to forget what they learned faster and think in a more superficial fashion. So the more interested we are in kids who love learning, prefer challenge, and want to think deeply, the less we have to be grading them, and the more we have to be thinking about other ways to assess the classroom.
Well, let's talk about what we can do that's right then, starting with what I assume is your basic premise, that we have to nurture a love of learning. How do we do that?
You don't have to make kids love learning. You have to start by being committed to not killing the curiosity about the world that all students start out with. And there's at least 10 studies have found that children's intrinsic motivation, their curiosity, their disposition to figure stuff out, make sense of the world, starts out very high when they're young, and then, subject to worksheets, homework, quizzes, lectures, grades, standardized tests, behavior management programs, that desire to figure stuff out about the world begins quite reliably to tail off. And that's not an inevitable progression because it doesn't happen as much in schools that are less traditional and less teacher-centered. What we have to do, and what great teachers that I see all over the country and beyond doing when I visit, is starting with projects and problems and questions as the organizing principles of teaching, rather than facts and skills and separate disciplines. That's not to say that facts and skills don't count. It's to say that they exist in a context and for a purpose. And the other characteristics that tend to describe amazing classrooms where kids are disappointed when the final bell rings are, first, that it feels like a caring community of learners where we're in this together. We're never set against each other in a contest, and we're only rarely isolated from each other on separate desks. And second, the kids play an active role and as well as an interactive role in helping to design what it is they're learning and all the other features of the classroom, like how the furniture is arranged and what goes on the wall and what we're going to read next and where we're going to take our field trip. Because people of all ages tend to excel when they enjoy what they're doing, and they tend to enjoy what they're doing more when they have some voice.
Alfie Cohn is an expert on parenting and education. His latest book is called Feel Bad Education. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up next, the debate over homeschooling. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Is homeschooling a viable alternative to public schools? Astra Taylor thinks it can be. In fact, she embraces a more radical form of homeschooling called unschooling. But Dana Goldstein claims that homeschooling often undercuts support for public schools. Taylor, who's now an independent filmmaker, was an unschooler herself, while Goldstein is an education journalist who went to a diverse public school. The two have traded volleys with their articles in Slate and N+1 magazines around questions of whether homeschooling or unschooling provides more learning than public schools, and over which option is best for society as a whole. Steve Paulson spoke with them both.
Astra, let me start with you. To put this in context, I think we need to talk about your own experience of unschooling, which is a much more radical version of homeschooling. First of all, can you explain the philosophy behind unschooling?
Most people have an idea of what homeschooling is. It's having school at home. Unschooling is sort of the radical cousin to that. And the idea essentially is that we are learning animals. That's a phrase from John Holt, who actually coined the term unschooling. Children, what they do is learn. You don't need to teach a baby how to speak. You speak to it, and then, you know, it masters the art of speaking. So the idea is that you tap into a child's intrinsic desire to learn by sort of setting them free to explore. And it's a very romantic view of human nature, of education and pedagogy. And so when I think back to my childhood, I often envision it as a kind of nutrient-rich broth that my siblings and I were sort of allowed to absorb and move in. And, you know, there were no tests. There was no class time. Our parents were not our teachers. It was this very informal, child-centered experience. And we are not alone. This is a tradition that goes back decades, but again, really got started with John Holt in the 70s.
So what did you do if you didn't have regular class instructions? Now, this was not just sort of taking the curriculum that a lot of homeschoolers use and doing it at home. You had no set structure for a typical day?
No, there's no curriculum, no tests. You know, we would wake up in the morning and, well, what did we feel like doing that day? Maybe we felt like drawing or reading or playing or, you know, roaming around in the woods behind the house. You know, and the idea was that we would, you know, my parents had this sort of boundless faith that we were interesting people and we would find something interesting to do. And that, you know, my mother would say, when you're bored, you're boring. And so the idea was, you know, you should care about the world. You should care about learning. And, you know, you, the children, should pursue it. I shouldn't have to be sitting here with carrots and sticks driving you.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your essay in N+1, you go on to say unschooling worked for your family. I mean, you're all mm-hmm. literate. You know enough math to be able to balance a checkbook. You have all pursued various creative projects, you and your siblings, and you, of course, are a filmmaker. It all sounds pretty good. So, Dana, let me bring you into this conversation. Why did Astra's essay get under your skin?
I was sort of troubled by the notion of unschooling and homeschooling as well as a model or something we should look to in terms of how to think about improving public schools. And the reason why is because so few parents have the privilege, have the option of implementing this sort of education for their children. So we know that a third of all kids and half of poor children are being raised by a single parent. And it's just very rare for a single parent to have the option to have the massive outlay of labor that it takes to educate one's child at home. And then the other point that I brought up in my Slate article that I think is really important is that in our society, the social institutions, the public institutions that have the most buy-in are the ones that tend to attract political support and improve over time. So, for example, when you think about Medicare, it's very protected politically because almost all senior citizens do use it. And with public schools, we need to be broadly improving public schools. And there's a growing body of research on peer effects. And basically, the best way to summarize that is to say that children learn more when they're in a classroom with children who have invested parents in their education. So, for example, a poor child learns more when they're in a classroom that is not just 100% made up of poor children, but also has middle-class kids in it. While the middle-class child, their test scores, there's not a lot of evidence that their learning is impeded by the presence of less privileged kids. So I'm sort of making this argument in the Slate piece that we should really think twice about pulling children out of the public system, that if we want to invest in our public schools, if we want to improve them over time, there's a big argument to be made that everyone has a better outcome when more people invest and participate in public schools.
So it sounds like you're not really questioning whether homeschooling is as good as it's cracked up to be. Your focus is on the larger social good, whether homeschooling undermines support for the public schools. And you're saying that we need to do everything in our power to make public schools better.
Yeah, there's two ways I'd respond to that. First, it's clear that for individuals like Astra and her siblings, there can be many positive outcomes of homeschooling. And I've certainly met people who've been homeschooled, have had wonderful experiences, and are wonderful, well-rounded, socially adept adults. I'm not making the argument that some critics of homeschooling make, that it's bad for the child. I think for many children, it could be a very positive experience. I'm sort of asking parents who might be considering homeschooling and who do care, who do want to improve public schools, to think twice, because I think that having those sorts of parents and families participating in and invested in the public school system really does broadly improve public schools. And I think there's a lot of interesting research showing that students who attend public schools, who attend socioeconomically and racially diverse public schools, do carry a certain set of values with them into adulthood that are very positive. Now, I think it's clear from the debate that Astra and I have been having over the past couple of weeks that she and I share those values. So certainly you can bring those values into adulthood as someone who's been unschooled or someone who's been homeschooled.
The point that you just made, that you and Astra actually agree on certain principles, I mean, this is important to make because neither of you, as far as I can tell, is religious. And we know that a lot of families who homeschool do it for religious reasons. They often do. Christian families don't think that the public schools support their values, so they don't want to, you know, expose their kids to the public school environment. That is not what you're talking about. This is really a debate about what's the best kind of education for people with, I suppose you could say, liberal secular values.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'll just make the point that there's somewhere between 1 million and 2 million homeschoolers or unschoolers in the United States. We're not exactly sure how many there are because it's not a very well-regulated sector, so there's not a lot of data about it. But we know that more than half of those people are Christian conservatives, people who could broadly be described as doing this for religious reasons. However, the number of people who are secular and doing it is growing. It's very hard to say exactly what segment of these 2 million children are secular.
Okay, Astra, let me bring you back into the conversation here. Is homeschooling undermining support for public schools?
I don't think it is. One thing I said in my reply to Dana was that the number of radical unschoolers or even secular homeschoolers pales in comparison to the number of parents who use the public school system but do everything in their power to move to the best school districts and get their kids to the best schools. Just the other day, the mother in Connecticut who put her child into a better school using, I think, a family member's address, was just charged with stealing education. She's being asked to pay $15,000 for stealing education, and she's going to jail for it. You know, that's someone who tried to move her kid into a better school district, and that's the punishment.
Isn't it true that virtually every family, if they have any choice at all, is going to try to construct the best educational environment for their kids? I mean, whether it's out of school or in school, and if it's in school, aren't they going to try to do whatever they can to help their kids get ahead, their own kids?
Yeah, I think that they will. And I think Dana and I agree that what we need to do is think beyond the family and what's good for the individual family. And so, you know, one thing I think that unschooling, you know, the point of my unschooling piece actually was not just to praise, you know, staying home all day and doing whatever you want. In fact, the entire essay, and it's a long essay, is grappling with my ambivalence towards the implications of this tradition that I was raised in. It's a tradition that I love and feel has so much to offer in terms of its philosophy of learning and trust in children. But, you know, is it scalable? Is the world I want to live in one in which everybody stays home and is educated by their parents? You know, the answer is no. So, you know, what I wrestle with is what are the broader social implications? And I end up visiting this alternative free school in Albany that actually caters to inner city kids who have not been able to flourish in the public school system, or kind of, you know, it's a last resort for them to go to this democratic school.
So this is Albany, New York.
Albany Free School. And so these are issues I'm grappling with. So, you know, I think that actually all parents, whether they want to educate their kids at home or they use the school system, need to think about the larger social good. And so what I think unschooling does, the thought experiment of unschooling is not, what if everybody stayed home all day? That's not it. The thought experiment of unschooling is, what if we let go of the testing, the fostering of a sort of competitive ethos that focuses on grades, on being at the top of the class? What if we totally abandoned all of these aspects of instruction that we're so attached to, that we think we kind of need to coerce children into learning? You know, that's the thought experiment of unschooling. It's not the home part.
Dana, let me turn to you about that thought experiment. Do you basically agree with what Astra is saying?
I agree with Astra that I'd like to see public schools be more intellectually engaging and less obsessed with test scores and more student-driven and progressive in their pedagogical techniques. Where I disagree is that you need to look at a private school like the Albany Free School, or you need to look at a really radical social experiment like homeschooling or unschooling to find examples of that. I think in our political debate about education, public schools are often just painted as totally failing institutions. And as an education reporter who's been covering this sector for 6 years, I can say undoubtedly that there are just so many wonderful progressive public schools that embrace these same values that Astra's talking about. If you look at the Community Roots School in Brooklyn, New York, which is near to where I live, if you look at the Urban Assembly schools here in New York City, those are schools that are working within the confines of the public system, and they're embracing so many of these progressive curricular and pedagogical values. And so I'm very invested in the idea that when we think about how to improve public schools, we look at successful public schools. Because in our education reform debate, too often we say only charter schools, only strict discipline, no excuses charter schools, those are the only ones that are successful. Or the only way that we can successfully, you know, improve education is to totally get rid of all mandates about what students do and what students learn, which is just not, that's not realistic in our political debate. We're in an environment in which standards and accountability are driving the education reform conversation. But I think what's hopeful is that there are public schools that are existing within that climate and embracing progressive values. And those are the schools that I look at in a lot of my reporting.
A taste of the debate about public schools and homeschooling, or unschooling. Astra Taylor is an independent filmmaker, and Dana Goldstein, an education reporter. Steve Paulson spoke with him. If you'd like to read their articles on the debate, you'll find the links on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, higher learning behind bars. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Jody Lewin thinks about higher education in a way most of us never have before. She's executive director of the Prison University Project, a degree-granting program for the inmates of San Quentin State Prison in California, one of a handful of such programs in the country. Lewin told Steve Paulson that accessibility is everything when it comes to higher education.
For me, what's important is doing everything that one can to provide access to higher education to people who don't traditionally have access to it. I think that that's what's particularly compelling to me and also to a lot of the other folks who are involved with it. I think, you know, most of us know that the range of people, the range of students who make it into high-quality colleges and universities in the country is severely limited. You know, people growing up extremely poor or with parents who are addicted to crack or who have undiagnosed learning disabilities are barely represented in the higher education system. And that has all sorts of ramifications for the society at large, or all sorts of people who have a tremendous amount of firsthand knowledge and experience about what's going terribly wrong in this country, who are very disempowered and don't have not only access to the sort of professional and educational echelons of the society where a lot of decisions get made, but they don't even really have the opportunity to make their voices heard.
So what happens when these inmates enroll in these college classes? What kind of impact does it have?
Well, so first of all, students show up. They have to have a high school diploma or a GED to enroll. That's the sole requirement. About 90% of them are not ready to do college-level work, so they'll spend about the first year in college prep English and math classes. And then they will get started when they're ready in the college credit classes. And it's really interesting to watch. I mean, I think obviously, most of the people who show up know they want an education. It's obviously, the participation in the program is voluntary. So
these are highly motivated students.
Extremely highly motivated. But they're not necessarily highly confident. And so they'll show up and they'll work hard. But I think a lot of them in the beginning have some serious doubts about whether they're going to be capable of really doing the work. And what's interesting is sometimes when they do well, their first reaction is, well, this isn't really as hard as it is on the outside, is it? And in fact, the people who are teaching them are grad students and faculty from Berkeley, San Francisco State, Sonoma State, Stanford, and they certainly are, you know, among the most challenging teachers around. And we push the teachers hard to push the students hard and to make sure not to lower the standards in any way.
So this is not kind of the dumbed-down version of
college
here.
Not at all. Not at all. And that, for me, is one of the most deeply personal issues. To me, what's interesting is not only who has access to higher education in this country, but also who has access to what type, what quality of higher education. And what I see happening in the society at large is a lot of people are, on the one hand, working hard to increase access to higher education to marginalized communities, either geographically or educationally in some way. But the problem is that the quality of education that they're providing, which is often distance learning based, is nothing like the kind of education that you would get, for example, here at Madison, at University of Wisconsin, or at Berkeley, or at any of the other schools that we're talking about. And I resent that deeply. You know, I feel like in a way, this society is actually not going to change until we democratize higher education at the higher end.
Tell me about some of these people. Tell me about the change that some of these people have undergone through taking these college classes.
You know, it's interesting. There's a tremendous range. I mean, people have grown up in a lot of different places. They're, you know, our students range in age from 18 to about 70. They come from all over the place. Most of them, you know, were Californians, but a lot of them grew up in other places too. But, you know, I've had students who just had grown up in such an isolated environment. You know, for example, I knew a young guy who had never left his own neighborhood in his life. And I remember him saying, I don't know how it came up, but I think we had a guest lecturer come in who was from another country. And he said to me, I thought there were only universities in the United States. And I said, no, there are actually universities all over the world. And what made you think that? He said, well, because all these people come here to go to college. So I just figured there weren't any. I mean, that is sort of a universe or a framework for living and thinking that's so far outside of my experience. But so imagine then for him how the world is growing and shifting as he's in school, the things he's learning and studying and the conversations that he's participating in. I mean, there's that range of experience. And then I think there are also people who really just come into contact with parts of themselves. You know, for example, we have frequently run introduction to psychology, child development or clinical psych, and people encounter clinical academic knowledge in these classes that they, in a sense, have been looking for their entire lives, right? So, or in a sociology class, ways in which people have behaved or that they've seen other people behave that never made sense to them or that were extremely confusing and painful, they suddenly find a vocabulary, a conceptual vocabulary, and an environment and a community to discuss those things with. So you see a lot of self-awareness and growth in that sense of people really just linking up with a framework to think through their own experiences. And I think then once you have that kind of conceptual vocabulary, change takes on a whole new form because you're not just thrashing around in the dark anymore. You're actually oriented.
What is it like from the other side for the teachers who come in who might be professors at Berkeley, for instance, or some of the other local schools there? What's that experience like to teach in San Quentin Prison?
I think for the teachers, the experience is at least as life-changing as it is for the students. I've known a lot of people who changed their career paths as a result of teaching inside. And even if they remained in the same field, they did it very differently or they pursued, you know, very specific topics and ideas as a result. But and I've also known people who, for example, graduate students who moved away, you know, for their first job. And one of the first things they did was either find the local prison and the local educational program at the prison, or they started a college program at the local prison.
Why? Why did they want to work in a prison?
Well, I think some of them would say, I just want that experience of having highly motivated, energized, committed, respectful students.
Wait, so you're saying a lot of these people are more motivated, those who are taking the classes in prison than the people outside the conventional 4-year college are.
No, look, I mean, when I went to college, I had no choice. I mean, in my neighborhood, you got the death penalty if you didn't go to college. I mean, that most kids at most of the elite colleges and universities in this country are going because their parents told them they had to go or that they should go. Or because their friends are going. They're not necessarily going out of a burning desire to get an education or out of the knowledge of what education will do for them emotionally and intellectually and professionally. So imagine that. Imagine a classroom full of people who get it and who want the education, who are immensely grateful, who are just have that level of hunger. I mean, for teachers, it's like a drug. So I think, it may be altruistic in the beginning, but I think a lot of them really feel by the end that it's fairly selfish.
Hmm. Can you tell me about some of the other people who've gone through this program, not the teachers, but the students, and some of the changes that you've seen?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I am somewhat resistant to the narrative of transformation, you know, the sort of the narrative of redemption that's so common in discussions about education and recovery programs in prisons, you know, the model, the idea of rehabilitation of a human being. There are certainly a lot of people who feel that, you know, I remember one guy saying to me, I had no soul when I got to prison. That's one person who I think felt that he had been transformed by his educational experiences, that it had somehow woken him. So every new student attends a new student orientation in the beginning of their first semester. And we explain the logistics of the program and how it runs and do a bunch of paperwork with them. And very often when they first come in, I mean, everybody's perfectly pleasant, but they're often very shy and quiet and somewhat expressionless. And so since I usually start that orientation, I get to see their faces in the beginning and, you know, just sort of looking out in this field of just quiet, subdued listeners. And by the end, as they've heard about the program and how it works and that there's a college prep program and they don't need to worry if they feel like they're not ready, that we will help them get ready, they soften. And they relax, and they look hopeful and excited. And you know, we had Christmas Eve, we had an open mic, which has become a tradition of ours, sort of like a talent show, sort of part talent show, part poetry slam. And I remember a guy who actually came to San Quentin really recently, but has been in the system for about 12 years. As he walked out, you know, he shook my hand and thanked me, and he said, you know, this is the best Christmas I've had in 12 years. I don't know. I don't even know how to really describe my reaction to that. But there's something about the program's capacity to break through people's feelings that they're alone in the world that I think is probably its greatest gift.
Jody Lewin is the executive director of the Prison University Project, a degree-granting program for inmates at the San Quentin State Prison in California. Steve Paulson spoke with her.
...60% of all the men and women released from prison return to prison in the first 3 years. So statistically, your odds of succeeding are very small.
I have been in and out of the system since I was 8 years old. My mother had me when she was relatively young. She was 17 years old. My father was in prison since I was 5 years old, and he was never around when he was out of prison.
Well, when I first came to Sing Sing and I went to B Block, it's just like this feeling that came over me. It was dark, it was dirty, it was gloomy. And I remember that night silently crying to myself, like, oh man, what did I do to myself? What am I gonna do with my life? After 20 years, what am I gonna do?
Voices of participants in Sing Sing Prison's Hudson Link program, one of only a handful of prison-based degree-granting college programs in the country. It's called Hudson Link for Higher Education. Sean Pica is the director of Hudson Link and a graduate of the program. He served time for murder and emerged with a college degree. The program is the subject of a new documentary called 0% and takes its name from the fact that none of the inmates who participated in Hudson Link returned to jail. Pica told Ann Strangchamps about serving time for his murder conviction.
I went in when I was 16, and when I came home in 2002, I had more time in prison than out of prison. And when I left the gates of Sing Sing, I was 33 years old. The only thing I had with me was my college degree. It was a pretty scary time because I'd watched so many people come back over the years. And I found out soon enough that the only thing I needed was that degree. And it really, really leveled the playing ground for me.
Why? What's so important about a college degree if you're somebody getting out of prison?
I think that even while I went to school, and there were many of the older guys that would see me and say, hey, it's great you're staying positive and going to school while the rest of us are going to play cards or work out or watch TV. But just remember that even though that's a positive thing, it's never going to help you when you get out. I mean, that was the constant theme. And then when I did finally go home, one of the first jobs I got, I mean, I went in there confident because I really thought, this is not going to help me anyway. I'm going through the motions, but as soon as I get to the part where I say I was in prison and I was in prison for 16 years, they're going to just tell me, well, thanks, but no thanks. Every single job that I've had since I've been home, I'm 9 years now, I've had 4 different jobs, every one of them in the social services field, but each one of those organizations, one by one, would say, oh my goodness, we would love to have you on the staff. And it's one of those things, I think, in the social services field where, you know, that kind of background is really helpful.
So we should back up here. You went to prison when you were 16 for murder.
I did.
What happened?
Wow, I want to just say poor decision-making, but that really minimizes everything. I shot and killed my friend's father, and really, I mean, in the process of making that decision, did not think past anybody but myself. As a 16-year-old kid, I thought about it. I really went through the motions of thinking about the impact it would have on my life, what was going to happen, but I was going to help my friend even at the expense of myself. I never thought past me. I never thought about my family, my community, my friends. I mean, the implications of what I did reached so far beyond myself that, I mean, I didn't understand what I was doing.
This was a girl who came to you?
Yes, it was a friend of mine that I grew up with, and she had explained to me that there were things going on in her home that, long story short, her father shouldn't have been doing, and I shot and killed her father.
She asked you to?
She did.
What did you say when she asked you?
I said I would think about it, and then I did it.
I think I've read your parents were in law enforcement?
My father and my stepmother were both New York City cops at the time. My mom and her husband were nurses. So I was in a helping kind of family, but...
Helping kind of family, but on the other hand, more than any other kid, you must have known what the consequences might be.
Yeah, it was never about the consequences for me.
You didn't think about what after?
It was... I never really thought about anybody else but myself. Like, it was knowing that I was going to end up in jail and that, well, you know what, I was going to do whatever I had to do to help a friend. And when you go to prison, your whole family goes to prison. And that was the part that I didn't get. This wasn't a judgment that you were going to just make and deal with as a 16-year-old. Every single person around me, from friends to family to, you know, aunts and uncles, the neighborhood parents, I mean, everybody felt like they had let me down for the decision that I made, and it was really, really unbelievable. I can't even explain what it was like to feel like I had let so many people down with my own decision.
So you had thought that you were doing a favor for a friend, that you were killing a bad guy who was hurting somebody.
I thought I was going to do the right thing for the wrong reason.
And you were willing to take the consequences and go to jail? Was kind of as far as you got in your mind?
That was what I was thinking, yeah.
What happened once you got to jail?
Wow, I woke up in a world I didn't know existed. I mean, it was very different than anything that I had ever seen.
I've read that you said somewhere, thank God I went to jail.
Well, I feel like from the direction that I was going in, I feel like prison saved me in one sense because I was a 16-year-old kid that just thought I knew it all. Well, what 16-year-old doesn't, but, you know, no direction. There was definitely times when I thought that I escaped. Prison was my way out.
Because it forced you to deal with what you'd done?
With myself and my own issues and made me grow up really fast and mature. And then, of course, the end result was I'm using that experience, those 16 years, to help others. And don't get me wrong, if I could turn back the hands of time, I would not go through this again. But I did go through it, and I'm using this experience to help others.
So the thing that's remarkable here, well, there's so many things that are remarkable, but one of them is that having seen this film, 0%, you've used this education. You've turned yourself around, and now you're helping other people. But so are all those other guys who are in the program.
Yeah. Every one of the men and women that have been through the program are now home. I think it's 71 as of this week. Every one of those men and women are in the social services field. They're service coordinators, they're caseworkers, HIV AIDS outreach coordinators. They're helpers. So they're going back to communities that they had once hurt, but now as helpers. And it's very empowering for them, but it's also very empowering for the younger generation that sees a very tough group of people returning back to the community. But instead of coming back as tough guys, they're coming back as healers, as helpers. And, you know, instead of carrying weapons, they're carrying textbooks. Many of them have gone back for graduate degrees. So now they're home and they're continuing. And it's really been a powerful piece, especially since some of us go back to high schools and we speak during the day at different high schools. And we have a very powerful message, but it's an unusual message.
We know that the best opportunity for an individual who's coming out of a correctional facility is going to be a college degree.
I came a long way from being in the streets, being a destructive young man with no high school diploma, to coming to prison. And I'm becoming a positive role model to a lot of the young guys in the school building.
What kind of guys make the commitment, make the effort to do this?
This is one of the issues that we have, that it's an older student that gets in. Because for the most part, there are exceptions, but for the most part, the younger students, they're not ready. Because there's a lot going on. There's a lot of sacrifice. There's a lot of... You know, you have to really put your money where your mouth is to step into that classroom. And it's a scary proposition. Nobody wants to look like a dummy. And if you think about it, going to prison is not rock bottom. Failing in prison is rock bottom. So many of these men and women get to prison, and it's a seamless transition right back to whatever they were doing in the streets. So now they were running a block in East Harlem. Now they're running a block in A block in the prison. So they were selling drugs here, now they're selling drugs there. So to actually break from that, to try something different, to go into a classroom and take a chance that you can't do that is very scary. And I love the fact that part of my job is seeing that change. When a student steps in there for that first semester, and by the end of that semester says, wow, I can do this.
Do you remember the first class that did that for you?
It really wasn't that way for me. I've always struggled as a student academically. So for me, I remember going through some pre-college stuff before I was even allowed to get into college. And I was doing okay with that stuff. But once I sat in a classroom, I remember getting papers back with C's and C minuses and saying, wow, I'm going to have to put some work in this. This is not something I'm just going to, you know, show up and do and do well in. And that, you know, carrying a textbook to work, finding time during the day to read and do homework, and then go from work directly to the classroom. You got to remember, for me, it was in the 80s. And in the 80s, in the New York State Department of Corrections, everyone was required to work 7 days a week. So I would leave my cell at 4 a.m., go to the bakery, work in the bakery until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and go from there to school. And then get out of school at 9 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock. So somewhere in that time, I had to sit down in a corner somewhere while the rest of the guys were playing cards or whatever during their break times and study. And that was not easy for me.
You've told your story so much, and you still tell it actively to help other people and young people. I guess I'm figuring by now you've got a public story you can tell, you know, that you can get through okay. Is there a private story still... images, things that you wish you could get rid of that you can't?
You know what? I've been telling my story for so many years now. Even when I was still inside, I remember I was probably 18 or 19 and had a couple of years in already. And one of the older guys came to me at Comstock and said, I don't know if you know it, Sean, but there's a youth group here where the local teenagers come into the prison, you know, once a month. And there's a few of us that are cleared to the prison, and we go down and we talk to them about prison life and drugs and alcohol and second chances and decisions. And they said, you know, we'd like for you to be involved. And I said, oh, no. I said, I can't even help myself. How am I possibly going to help these kids? And the guy said, oh, no, we're not asking. It's Monday at 6. We'll see you there. So, all right, sorry. I mean, I thought you were asking. And I went down there. And really, for me, it wasn't about helping anybody else. There was such a big brother syndrome thing going on. And I was surviving literally under the wing of these guys. So I was going to show up because they said to, and that was it. I never thought about what I was about to say. And I walked in there that day, and one of the guys said to me, well, you'll talk about, you know, prison life. And I was the last guy to speak. And the first couple guys spoke about, you know, drugs and alcohol and choices and education. And it got to me, and I started to speak about what it was like for my family, for me to go to prison. I remember walking out of there, and everybody was crying. And Al said to me, Al was about, you know, 6'4", about 280 pounds. He said, Sean, that was brilliant. I said, I didn't do it on purpose. I don't know where it came from, because I hadn't cried in so many years. And I haven't stopped crying since.
Sean Pica is the executive director of Hudson Link for Higher Education, and a subject of the documentary called 0%. Anne Strangchamp spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge at our website, ttbook.org, where you will also find years of TT Book interviews. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Rethinking Education. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Doug Gordon, Anne Strangchamp, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.